It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios. Welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4 to 1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
Are you okay with Erdogan saying that he is not going to do a ceasefire?
He didn't say that at all. He's meeting, and he's meeting today with some of our representatives. Mike Pence is leaving today, as you know. We needed to take an extra day for security reasons. But Mike is leaving. Mike Pompeo will be meeting also, who's here right now with us, and he's going to be joining the meeting. We have a lot of great people over there. We'll see. In the meantime, our soldiers are not in harm's way, as they shouldn't be, as two countries fight over land. That has nothing to do with us. And the Kurds are much safer right now, but the Kurds know how to fight. And as I said, they're not angels. They're not angels. If you take a look, you have to go back and take a look. But they fought with us. We paid a lot of money for them to fight with us, and that's okay. They did well when they fought with us. They didn't do so well when they didn't fight with us. When I refused to allow the Americans a year and a half ago to fight with the Kurds against Iraq, I said, wait a minute. This country stupidly just spent a fortune on fighting for, with, around Iraq. Nobody knows how they spent it. But they spent, actually, we're in the Middle East now for $8 trillion, if you can believe that stupidity. But in Iraq, we're in for probably $5.5 trillion. So they're telling me, wait a minute, we just spent $5.5 trillion fighting in Iraq and with Iraq. And now we're supposed to spend money to fight with the Kurds against Iraq. I said, no, thank you.
All right, Sandy Rios, with you, so much happening this week, especially in regard to what's happening with the Turkey, Syria, and the Kurds. Nothing has caused the president as much backlash from his own party as his decision to draw 50 American troops out of the northeastern part of Turkey and Syria on their border there, where the Kurds are, where we've fought with the Kurds for a number of years. And so I think we need to set the record straight. I've been confused about this myself, but I want to shed a little more light onto that situation as best I can. You know that this week the House overwhelmingly passed a resolution condemning the president for taking our troops out of that area. And the allegation, of course, is that we are deserting our friends, the Kurds. That's the narrative that you see in the news. We've seen the news go so far as ABC playing, you know, tape of a gun range in Kentucky and claiming that it is the fight between the Kurds and the Turks. For that reason alone, you should suspect what you are hearing. Let me also point out that in the House, on that vote of condemnation, which of course was led by the Democrats, most of the Republicans, probably 120 of them, joined in on that resolution, but 70 did not. And most of those people were Freedom Caucus members and people that personally I trust. And not the others. You know, the others are not, they are not all in for President Trump. You know that. And they're not, they're going to oppose him whenever they can. They've done it repeatedly. So that's not our barometer of how we should feel about this action. Nevertheless, it's very confusing. I've said it to you. I don't fully understand it myself. I want to give you an idea, just a touch of a different perspective on this. Carolyn Glick is someone who writes for the Jerusalem Post, who I admire greatly. And she wrote an article for Front Page Magazine in which she says, the near consensus view of U.S. President Donald Trump's decision to remove American special forces from the Syrian border with Turkey is that Trump is enabling a Turkish invasion and double-crossing the Syrian Kurds who have fought with the Americans for 5 years against the Islamic State. Trump's move, the thinking goes, harms U.S. credibility and undermines U.S. power in the region and throughout the world. Is that not what you're hearing? Is that not what you're hearing even from Fox and from some of the generals? I believe that is what you're hearing. She says there are several problems with this narrative. The first is that it assumes that until this week, the U.S. had power and influence in Syria, when in fact, by design, the U.S. went to great lengths to limit its ability to influence events there. The war broke out in 2011 in Syria. It was a popular insurrection by Syrian Sunnis against Iranian-sponsored President Bashar al-Assad. The Obama administration responded by declaring U.S. support of Assad's overthrow, but the declaration was empty. The administration sat on its thumbs as the regime's atrocities mounted. It supported a feckless Turkish effort to raise a resistance army dominated by jihadist elements aligned with the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, let me just tell you, I cannot read all of this. And if I did, you would be scratching your head saying who is what and where and why. But you would see in this that even among the Kurds, there are factions. You would see that the president is right, that they're not all our friends. Many of them are. And yes, it's true. For those that have worked with us, it is really hard to pull out from there. But you would also see that we only have 50 troops there. Carolyn goes on to describe those. Some have said they're like human shields. And our soldiers should not be human shields. There's no way they could take out this conflict. Erdogan, it sounds to me, from what I'm reading, called the president to call his bluff on that part of Turkey. There is an Islamic faction that's been fighting the Turks for decades, and some of them are Kurds and some of them are not. It's a decades-old dispute, some would say a 100-year-old dispute. So now it looks as though the Kurds are going to form an alliance with Bashar al-Assad, which some believe is a good thing. Rand Paul, who I don't usually agree with, but I'm actually listening to him on this, and he's making some sense, did an interview that kind of laid it out. Let's listen.
You might be President Trump's biggest supporter when it comes to the move to withdraw U.S. service members from northern Syria. What advice did you offer the president before he made this decision?
He and I didn't talk one-on-one on it. This was his decision, but I agree completely that it was the best thing not only for our troops, but it's also the best way to adhere to the Constitution. The Constitution says you don't declare a war unless Congress votes on it. And who are we going to declare war against? Our ally Turkey, the Free Syrian Army that used to be our ally, Assad? It's a sort of a messy situation, but he was told by the Turks that they were coming one way or another. And they had 50 troops. 50 troops don't stop 10,000 troops. You don't go to war with 50 troops. I think he made the right decision. I'm reminded of Beirut when we made the wrong decision and had 300 Marines in a barracks that weren't well protected. I think if 50 troops had been massacred in there, then we'd be in an enormous war. So I think he made the right decision.
You really think that Erdogan would have sent the Turks across the border with U.S. service members? I mean, that's the only thing that had kept them from attacking before.
Well, no, I don't think so. I think that what you found is in the early footage you saw, and I think you all showed some of this footage, that you saw some of our special operations teams having bombs still dropping very close to them.
Right.
So they didn't seem to be deterred, even though we still had soldiers in the region. So I think it was strategically the best thing to do. But also, here's the thing that may end up happening. This may be the best thing that ever happened to the Kurds because they need a protector in Syria that's willing to stay. We had been preventing having them talk to Assad. Now they've made an alliance with Assad. And the irony of this is it may end up being the best thing that ever happened to them. If Assad and Erdogan can now have a truce and Assad will agree to patrol the Syrian side of this, there's a possibility that the Kurds could have an autonomous region similar to what they have in Iraq.
That seems like very wishful thinking, if you don't mind my saying.
We'll see, Jake. So nobody knows.
The president's former point man on ISIS said today that, quote, U.S. personnel have been scrambling to evacuate positions surrounded by hostile Turkish-backed opposition forces. They're evacuating under duress and then bombing positions so nobody can seize them. Do you have any concerns about, forget the idea of withdrawing U.S. forces, we understand that you support that. Do you have understanding about the way many people feel this was rash, it was sudden, it was not done in consultation with the Pentagon, it was not done in consultation with the State Department, with U.S. allies, and there are Kurds who are innocent civilians who have been killed by the Turks and the Turkish-backed militias.
He said from the very beginning our goal was to wipe out ISIS, and we did. Our goal was not to create a homeland for the Kurds.
But ISIS prisoners are getting free out of the prisoner.
Well, if you want to have a homeland for the Kurds, it might take 100,000 troops. That's not what we signed up for. That's not what he said we were for. And I'm not for putting that kind of troops into an area.
Yes, well, okay, so we got to interrupt it, but, and we could play the rest of it, but I just want to say that Rand lays out a very compelling case for why he supports the president. And I have to say that I just don't think people can be so certain about this. I've had people write me and talk about how the president's made a terrible mistake. It's a disaster. I'm not sure they can say that. This is just too complex. And the one thing he did was make a decision that was good for American troops. With the rules of engagement that Barack Obama laid out, our troops were doing nothing more than policing. He's right about that. And they are in harm's way. And he said, it's time to bring them home and let that part of the world sort themselves out. Now, that makes sense to me. Now, whether this is going to turn out to be a good or bad thing, I don't know. I just don't know. And so that's the way it sits. And of course, it's causing a big brouhaha in Washington. And I think the Democrats are delighted that many of the Republicans voted against the president on this in the House. Will you please remember that there's an election coming up in 2020? And many people who are serving in the House and in the Senate do not support the president. And any chance they have to hurt him, they take it. That's true of a lot of never-Trumpers, too. It's just amazing to me. On another topic, which is Ukraine, there are some really important developments that have happened that I want to just share with you as quickly but as clearly as I possibly can. You remember that the Ukrainian ambassador testified before. Remember that the House is conducting an impeachment inquiry. And the inquiry is based on this phone call with President Trump and the president of Ukraine, in which they claim the president was threatening to withhold aid if they did not fire this, if they did not investigate Joe Biden and his son Hunter Biden and the connection to Burisma, this big energy company that Hunter Biden was making tons of money off of without having any experience whatsoever, nothing to offer except his name. And so that's so the accusation is that President Trump was trying to get his potential presidential rival. All right, so they're conducting all these inquiries, but of course they're doing it behind closed doors. And so one of those behind closed doors investigations included U.S. Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch. Judicial Watch has discovered some really important things this week. It looks as though U.S. Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch, who was appointed by Barack Obama and let go by President Donald Trump, she's still at the State Department. She testified in secret to the House impeachment inquiry against Donald Trump last Friday. And her secret testimony, though, secret, tongue-in-cheek, was leaked to the New York Times. Of course, the things that were leaked were not to Trump's advantage. That's what always gets leaked. It looks like Yovanovitch may have violated laws and government regulations by ordering subordinates to target certain U.S. persons using State Department resources. Yovanovitch reportedly ordered monitoring keyed to the following search terms: Biden, Giuliani, Soros, and her own name, Yovanovitch. And so prior to being recalled as ambassador to Ukraine in the spring, Yovanovitch reportedly created a list of individuals who were to be monitored via social media and other means. And so this is public knowledge. This is not an obscure rule. Everyone in public diplomacy or public affairs knows they can't make lists and monitor U.S. citizens unless there is a major national security reason. Yovanovitch is a career diplomat who has also led American embassies in Kyrgyzstan and Armenia. She was appointed again by Obama in 2016. She was recalled by the State Department in May, but she remains at the State Department. She was looking to surveil people like Donald Trump Jr., Laura Ingraham, Sean Hannity, Dan Bongino, Rudy Giuliani, Sebastian Gorka, John Solomon, Lou Dobbs, Pam Geller, Sarah Carter. So this is, you know, interesting little testimony that was leaked behind closed doors, of course, supposed to be quiet because we don't want to put these testimonies or testifiers at risk. But all of this gets leaked. Her negative conversations about President Trump get leaked to the New York Times. But now we know her background. And that's very helpful to know. We also know that a top diplomat, George Kent, a State Department official who works on your agency's Ukraine portfolio, directly contradicted claims that Obama administration was merely following the lead of the so-called international community. He says, I'm telling you, he said that Barack Obama himself is the one that orchestrated the Ukraine prosecutor's firing. So that we also know. So we're finding out a few things behind those closed-door sessions, and it's very helpful. Rachel Bovard is really national treasure. She's really plugged into what's happening on Capitol Hill, so she's going to join us next to fill in some of those details that I might have missed. Sandy Rios in the morning, AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
In the list that you gave me of the reasons why you're on that board, you did not list the fact that you were the son of the vice
president. Of course, yeah. No.
What role do you think that played?
I think that it is impossible for me to be on any of the boards that I just mentioned without saying that I'm the son of the vice president of the United States.
You were paid $50,000 a month for your position?
Look, I'm a private citizen. One thing that I don't have to do is sit here and open my kimono as it relates to how much money I make or did or didn't. But it's all been reported.
If your last name wasn't Biden, do you think you would have been asked to be on the board of Burisma?
I don't know. Probably not. I don't think that there's a lot of things that would have happened in my life that that if my last name wasn't Biden.
That was Hunter Biden. And that was an interview he did on ABC earlier this week, the morning of the Democratic debate. And of course, Joe Biden said he had no idea Hunter was going to do that interview and et cetera, because, of course, he never talks to Hunter Biden about what he's doing with Ukraine or China. He has no knowledge of that. That's what he's told us. Now, interestingly, we're all talking about whether these sons of famous men should be, you know, doing any kind of business overseas. It was very interesting to hear Eric Trump ask about Hunter Biden. They're probably about the same age. They both, you know, are proud of their dads and have worked, have had pretty high profile positions because of their fathers. And Eric, and so, of course, the Trump boys have been accused of doing, well, according to some, they've done the same thing. It's no different. The Trump kids do the same thing that Hunter Biden has done. So this is Eric Trump's response to that kind of accusation. Let's listen.
The difference between us and Hunter is when my father became commander in chief of this country, we got out of all international business, right? When his father became vice president of the United States, he got into international business. That's the difference. But my father got into politics to drain the swamp, to stop this nonsense from happening, exactly what you see here, because it's rampant. He made so many sacrifices, including putting a ton of his own money into it and including losing an absolute fortune because of it. All these guys are cashing in on it. They're taking board positions. They're cashing in on their father. I mean, do you see me on any boards? Do you see Don on any boards? Do you see Ivanka on any boards?
Yeah, so that was just part of that discussion. I thought that was interesting, and I wanted to share that with you. Well, Rachel Bovard is one of my favorites. Rachel is on Capitol Hill. She has been for a number of years. Well, she's kind of in proximity to Capitol Hill. She's not working there now, but she was there with working for Rand Paul and also Senator Mike Lee and Senator Pat Toomey. She now works with Senator Jim DeMint, who was one of my favorite senators during his time on Capitol Hill. She also was director of policy services at Heritage, but now she's with what is now called Conservative Partnership Institute. And she wrote an article which caught my eye called Hunter Biden's Wild Ukrainian Ride. Rachel, thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, Rachel, this is not the first time I've talked about this, obviously, on the air, but in your own words, the case is being made that Hunter didn't do anything. He said it himself. It might have looked bad, but I really didn't do anything wrong. And I just want to know if your research would comport with that conclusion.
Well, what he did was obviously in violation of a conflict of interest. And the interesting thing about this is that for years, this was a known situation in Washington. The New York Times, The New Yorker, The Washington Post all reported on the fact that wherever Joe Biden was making policy as vice president, Hunter Biden was making a profit. And it's not just in Ukraine. It was in China. It was on the board of credit card companies that his dad was passing policy about. This has been going on for years. And, you know, it was an open secret in Washington, but no one raised an issue because, you know, Hunter Biden and Joe Biden believe all the right things that the D.C. cocktail set believes. So this kind of self-dealing was tolerated. But let's be very clear. It was overt self-dealing. And, you know, this is the kind of soft corruption that is loath to voters. And for Democrats and Joe Biden to pretend this is not an issue is insulting, I think, to the thousands of people that would probably say otherwise.
It is really so tasteless. You know, Rachel, that's the kindest word I can think of. I heard Hunter in that interview that he gave with ABC talking about how he really didn't do anything wrong, that it was just because he knew his positions were because he knew his dad, but it really wasn't wrong. Also, they're sort of downplaying. It's like, even as we're talking about it, it's like, well, he got a good job because of his dad, but we're talking about huge amounts of money, aren't we?
Oh, huge amounts of money. $50,000 a month to serve on the board of a Ukrainian gas company. He had no knowledge or expertise in the subject. And moreover, This Ukrainian gas company, the name is Burisma, is controlled and owned by one of the most corrupt oligarchs in the world. And so, and this was a note, he was under investigation when Hunter joined the board. And so this was why he thought this incredibly corrupt oligarch, known for his very violent business practices, why Hunter Biden thought that would be a great colleague of his is unclear. Really bad judgment on that. But again, you know, this is a tremendous amount of money. To the point Eric Trump made in that clip, this is the distinction. Hunter Biden saw an opportunity to make money trading off his dad's access and his dad's name, and he took that opportunity. And unfortunately, this is the trend for political families in Washington, D.C. The reason it's never been called out until now is because they all tolerate it, because they all benefit from it.
Well, I think so. And I really think that that's, I've said before and will say again, Rachel, that one of the reasons that Washington, D.C. elites on both sides have sort of howled at this exposing of Joe Biden and Hunter Biden's use of the system to enrich themselves, really, is because so many of them are guilty of it, Republicans and Democrats. You know, Peter Schweitzer, yeah, I guess, is the champion on uncovering some of the business. I've heard so many names, Bob Corker, some of his business dealings. How do they go to Washington as regular guys with maybe pretty good jobs and then leave as multimillionaires? There's a reason for that, isn't there, Rachel?
No, there is. And it's because the access and the leverage and the connections in Washington provide opportunities for this kind of self-dealing. And as you point out, it's been protected by both political parties for years. And Peter Schweitzer has done yeoman's work reporting on this. He did the majority of the documentation of the Hunter Biden story, and of course is now being written off by mainstream media as a right-wing conspiracy theorist, but his work is incredibly well-documented, and he does it on both sides, for both Democrats and Republicans. So his book, Secret Empires, takes you behind the curtain on this kind of self-dealing in Washington.
Well, and one other thing before we leave this topic, I believe it's Hunter Biden's position on a board in China. I believe that's the one he resigned from this week. Is that correct? I believe it's that. And promising that if his dad is elected president, he will, I don't know, divest himself of these relationships. But the disingenuous part of it is that Hunter has, I can't explain these high-level financial dealings, but he has a company that has holdings, and somehow they are the front company for the involvement in Burisma. He personally is on the board, but his company is invested. And so his partner in his own company is still very much involved. And I think we're talking about, really, if millions, if not billions of dollars, Rachel. So that just because he stepped off the board doesn't mean that he's not going to financially benefit. That's the point I guess I'm trying to make.
That's a very important point, especially with the Chinese company. He may not be on the board, but he still has his equity investment in the company. So he will still be making money from whatever goes on if his dad becomes president in relation to China.
Rachel, let's change the subject because you know the inner workings of D.C. well. I know some of it, but not the way you do, not the system as well as you do. I understand in general what's going on here, but not the ins and outs. And so I wanted to ask you, we'll go backwards here. Let's talk about something that happened really recently this week, and that was the walking out of the meeting at the White House. A sit down with President Trump at that big table that you've probably been at and I have been to, where Nancy Pelosi is seen in this photo standing up, which generally speaking, people on that table don't stand up when they speak. But Nancy marched out of the room, went to the microphone with Chuck Schumer, and claims that she was very badly treated. Schumer defended her and said the president was rude to her, while Nancy Pelosi stood next to Schumer smiling weirdly. Very strange smile for a person that was supposedly so offended. I have a prejudice, yes, I do. But what do you know about that meeting and what happened?
Well, I tend to think that it went exactly as planned for Nancy Pelosi. You know, she started the conversation by accusing the president of being basically the asset of a foreign agent. She accused him of being in bed with the Russians in the White House, and he got upset by that, and then she stormed out and went straight to the TV cameras. And if you watch Nancy Pelosi in any of these White House meetings, that is de rigueur for her. That is her playbook. Something appalling happens, and she runs straight to the TV cameras outside the White House. But I think President Trump reportedly comment to her on the way out was, okay, bye, see you at the polls, which I think is true to some extent. Like, this is all being done in a very carefully calculated way, designed to manipulate voters. So we'll see if it actually works. But that was straight out of the Nancy Pelosi playbook.
Rachel, I believe you heard a briefing I heard yesterday about what's happening with the polls. I talked about that Fox poll last week before last, I guess, that was so skewed, I think, by something like, I want to say 18 points, 8 or 18 points toward the Democrats. But they didn't say that when they released their results. And what we keep hearing, even from Fox, is that they are supporting this impeachment process and the numbers are growing and it's building. But my understanding is that actually those are polls for the media. And most of them are sort of, many of them, if not all, are conducted to persuade us to certain things. But that the behind-the-scene polls show a very different story. Do you know anything about that?
Well, I do know that, you know, that there's been a number of polls released since that Fox poll, most recently on October 14th, just a couple of days ago. A Reuters poll came out showing that a two-point drop in the number of Americans who feel Trump should be impeached. So I do think, you know, impeachment is actually on the wane. Support for impeachment is on the wane, which is not unsurprising, right? The longer this becomes a nakedly partisan exercise, which is transparent, Democrats are making it transparently obvious that it is, the less support you're going to see for it. And I think that you're starting to see that. But also in this poll, which I thought was interesting, was that 60% of Americans say they actually want to focus on legislation. And that's going to be a key problem for Democrats who aren't doing any of that. They're spending their entire legislative session trying to impeach the president in secret. They're not actually addressing problems of real Americans. So, you know, I think that that's a very interesting intersection for Democrats that they're going to have to deal with. It runs the risk of backfiring on them.
Yes. And what I'm actually hearing is that the political polls, inside that I'm sure Nancy Pelosi has access to, and so does President Trump, show that the Democrats are in trouble, actually. And that the American people don't really feel the way the public polls are reflecting. That's my sense of it. But of course, how would we know? We don't know till we actually see people vote. But I'm sure that I'm wondering, then, Rachel, if the reason why Nancy Pelosi again has refused, even in the last few days, to call a vote on impeachment is because she knows that those polls are not in her favor.
Yeah, it's a very, very telling issue, the fact that Nancy Pelosi refuses now for the third time to have a full House vote on whether or not the House should proceed with impeachment, probably because she knows it would fail. She doesn't even have the support within her own conference. There are 30 House Democrats sitting in districts that Trump won in the last presidential election. She doesn't want to put them in a bad place. This is a dangerous time for Democrats, and they're further harming themselves by the impeachment proceedings that they are doing are all done in complete secrecy. So they're not even making the public case, and they're not allowing the public to have access to the information they're saying contains all this, you know, high crimes and misdemeanors that will justify impeachment. If Democrats think that they can actually impeach a president on the basis of secret evidence and secret proceedings, I think they have another thing coming, because the American people are always smarter than politicians give them credit for. But particularly on this, you have to think they're not going to stand for it.
Let's drill down on these testimonies for a second. I mentioned a few of them before you joined me. But it seems as though, you know, Rachel, initially the president said, we're not cooperating with this. It's a sham procedure. You haven't even held a vote. You can't do this in secret. I'm not going to let my people come testify for you. But then this week we've had, I don't know, two, three, maybe members of the administration, one from the State Department. I can't even think of names right offhand, but we've had several of them come to testify. Why are they, I guess they're free to do what they want, but what's your perspective on why they are sort of ignoring the president and testifying anyway?
Well, I think they're worried about themselves legally. And I think, you know, that's the unfortunate sort of human cost of this impeachment inquiry, is that you are putting individuals who are serving the president in individual legal peril. And I think that they you know, become worried about about that. So, you know, but what's tough to know without any of this being public is what exactly they are saying, because we only see what Democrats decide to leak out of these hearings. And so, for instance, when Kurt Volker, who was this in charge of Ukraine for the president, testified before the secret committees, House Democrats selectively released a handful of text messages that they show, or they claim, demonstrate quid pro quo. However, Kurt Volker's testimony, which was leaked by him, demonstrates the exact opposite. And so it's hard for us to get a sense, you know, they may be going in defending the president, saying he didn't do anything wrong, but we can't see that because Democrats aren't making any of this public.
Yeah.
And so it's a really difficult track with what's actually being said.
Rachel, hold on for a second, because we have to take a bit of a break. I did not say that Rachel has, there are several articles she's written that I want to highlight. One is this Hunter Biden's wild Ukrainian ride. We'll put that on our Facebook page so that you can see it. Also, Rachel is the author of a new book along with Jim DeMint called Conservative, Knowing What to Keep. We're going to talk about that too, and all other things impeachment. So please stay tuned. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
It's very bizarre, Sean. On September 12th, about a month ago, the Judiciary Chairman launched the impeachment inquiry. And today, Adam Schiff removed me as a member of the Judiciary Committee from the deposition he was taking. This is proof that Democrats can't win a fair election, they can't win a fair debate, and they absolutely cannot run a fair impeachment inquiry because they're stacking the deck. They're doing everything they can to limit our access to witnesses and evidence. They're not allowing us to call witnesses. And by the way, if Republicans had a witness list, it would be Adam Schiff, who would be a fact witness because of the collusion that he was and his staff were engaged in with the whistleblower that they then lied about. So look, we're going to keep fighting to get to the facts here, but time and again, we see that Adam Schiff is running a kangaroo court, and that should matter to senators who may have to ultimately consider this impeachment, that it was done in a totally roughshod way. Even Republicans didn't treat Bill Clinton this bad. They had the opportunity to have minority subpoenas and have the president's lawyers in the room asking questions. They went through that with the Russia investigation. They allowed us to ask Mueller questions and ask Lewandowski questions. They didn't like the result, so now they're trying to reshuffle the deck, and I think it's a shameful day for the House of Representatives.
That's Congressman Matt Gaetz, and there's no exaggeration there. That's exactly what's happening, because when the Republicans, at least the 70 or so good ones, from my perspective, in the House of Representatives are given the opportunity to cross-examine, look what they did with Bob Mueller. They revealed what a disappointing, feckless man he is, and they did that by their questioning. And so Matt is right. They don't want these Republicans, these good guys who really have fire in their belly, questioning these witnesses. And by the way, Matt, earlier in this week, sorry, Congressman Gaetz, was thrown out of a meeting, one of those hearings by Adam Schiff. I don't know if Adam Schiff actually manhandled Matt Gaetz. Do you know, Rachel, was there personal one-on-one with those guys?
I don't think it got physical, thankfully, but
yeah,
I won't rule it out.
But no, I know. It is. Yeah, I wouldn't rule that out either, actually. But I don't think Matt is the only person that tried. He's on the, to be clear, Congressman Gaetz is on the Judiciary Committee, which is the committee which, if this were a real, honest-to-goodness, constitutional impeachment, they would be the one doing these hearings. But instead, it's the Intelligence Committee. I want to ask you, what will the death of Elijah Cummings have? What effect will that have on all this impeachment stuff in the House, you think?
Well, I think it could have a huge effect. You know, Congressman Cummings was chair of the House Oversight Committee, which has a role to play in some of this impeachment proceedings. I think, you know, the House will need to stop and pay their respects, obviously. So I think it will slow the roll a little bit, I think, of these proceedings going forward. And, you know, I also hope that it maybe puts to bed a little bit of, or at least puts to rest a little bit of the shirts and skins mentality that they have in the House right now. Elijah Cummings was a political progressive, but well known for his friendships across the aisle. Mark Meadows, a conservative firebrand congressman, was one of his best friends. And so I hope people, you know, this we all strive to live up to an example of that kind of behavior, which really doesn't exist in our politics anymore.
No, I know. It's just, it is amazing. It really is. It doesn't exist in our families or our neighborhoods either. It reminds me very much of reading about the atmosphere during the Civil War, Rachel, when families were divided and they had to make choices they didn't want to make. You had to decide. You couldn't be neutral. And I think we're kind of heading there. And I think that's, you're seeing it on the front lines in Washington. You mentioned Adam Schiff and these secretive hearings. Byron York has a really excellent piece that just came out in the last day or so about Schiff pushing Ukraine Representative Kurt Volker to try to say that Ukraine was feeling pressure from Trump. And Byron actually publishes the back and forth between them. I'm not sure how he got this. Actually, Rachel, I'm not sure. But he's got it exactly. And Schiff goes on and on. He says, are you sure? Are you sure? And he finally ends up with completely exasperated. And Schiff says, Ambassador, I find it remarkable as a career diplomat that you have difficulty acknowledging that when Ukraine learned that their aid had been suspended for unknown reasons, that this wouldn't add additional urgency to the request by the President of the United States. I find that remarkable. This is after a back and forth that went on and on, where Volker held fast and said no. There was no pressure. There was no quid pro quo. So some of these testimonies are not working out well for the Democrats.
Yeah, and I think you're starting to see them unravel a little bit, and that's why they are keeping them secret, because I think if they made them public, you know, it would unravel their narrative, because, again, everything we're getting is from leaks, right? We're getting leaks from the Democrats, and then you're seeing Republicans, I think, try and counter their leaks with their own leaks. And, you know, in doing so, you're starting to see how much Democrats are flailing. They are trying to create a narrative out of thin air, and they're trying to bully everyone into supporting it. And that's a really, really dangerous thing. Because remember, impeachment is one of the most solemn constitutional obligations that Congress has. It is, you know, not a nakedly partisan exercise. And when you look at the previous two modern impeachments of Nixon and Clinton, the opposing party took pains to make sure it did not become a partisan circus. They, you know, went over and above board to try and make everything transparent, to try to make sure the president had, you know, access to everything, had his lawyers present, you know, had ability to question witnesses, all these things, because they didn't want it to become a tool of partisan angling. We are seeing the exact opposite behavior from House Democrats right now, and it threatens our politics in a very existential way, because if impeachment now becomes a partisan tool, that is going to change how we do everything going forward. And I think that's a really dangerous thing.
I do too, Rachel. And let me just verify what you just said. I was on radio in Chicago in the 90s during the Clinton impeachment hearing, and I was doing a 3-hour drive time. So I lived and breathed that. And Congressman Henry Hyde, who was the chairman of the House managers who were charged with the impeachment, was a very good friend of mine. And so I had real access to what was going on, plus the chief investigator was a good friend. All these people became well known to me. I interviewed them constantly. And the thing that I remember well was the sobriety and respect they approached this whole thing with. It was truly remarkable. I mean, they were appalled by what President Clinton had done. And it wasn't just about Monica Lewinsky. It was so many other things. They were appalled by his behavior and his policies, as appalled as some people are at Trump, but they treated this whole thing with such dignity, and that it was not a circus as this is. So I just wanted to confirm what you had just said. Let's talk about one other thing before we jump off of impeachment. The Senate has been really milquetoast from my perspective, Rachel, on what's happening. And first of all, cut to the chase. Is the Senate obligated, if there's no vote? I guess there would have to be a vote in the House before impeachment articles could actually be sent to the Senate. Wouldn't there have to be?
Yes, there would at some point. A vote is required in the House to send official articles of impeachment to the Senate. Those articles have not been written. You know, there is no substance yet to what that vote would look like. But at some point, the House will be required to vote on the articles of impeachment, probably on the basis of a bunch of secret evidence, as we're seeing.
Yeah. And many people think that that's going to happen before Thanksgiving or by Thanksgiving, that the Democrats want to push this through quickly. I just don't know. But so the Senate, in your Mitch McConnell came out early on, pretty much, after Nancy Pelosi announced the inquiry, and said, "Well, we will have to. If it comes over, we will have to do whatever we have to do." I forgot his exact words. What could the Senate do? Couldn't the Senate indicate that this is kind of a circus? Could they not say something that's constitutional and indicates that they don't have respect for a disrespectful process?
Yes, they could make a motion and vote to dismiss the entire thing. They basically have two choices. They can vote to dismiss it, or they can take it to a full trial. And that is something that honestly will be up to Senator McConnell and how he decides to handle it. But I would point out that the motion to dismiss these proceedings would be at a 51 vote threshold. There are a number of Republicans who have already broken with the president, namely Mitt Romney, Ben Sasse, you know, others who have raised questions. So I don't know where they would be on that vote. But they have an option to dismiss it rather than take it to trial.
But could they dismiss it? Could Mitch McConnell just dismiss it, or would he have to take a vote to dismiss it?
He would have to take a vote.
Well, would that require 2/3 or 51?
No, it would only require a simple majority. So 51 a majority of senators present would be required.
Well, that makes me really nervous because, you know, for the reasons you just said, plus there are other names. I think of Richard Burr. I think of Tom Tillis. I'm just not sure. That the president is, I think he's unlikely to be well covered in the Senate. I'm not even sure about Mitch McConnell when push came to shove, to be honest with you. And we certainly can't trust John Roberts as a Supreme Court justice. So the president is not out of danger. And the reason I say we is because I think most of us who support this president understand this is about the future of this country. And it's the constitutional republic. It is not about one man. It is and it isn't. Because that one man does stand between us and what I think I perceive as a bit of disaster. Rachel, I want to talk for a second about your new book that you wrote with former Senator Jim DeMint, and it's called Conservative, Knowing What to Keep. Tell us a bit about what it is you guys were trying to communicate in this book.
Yeah, so Senator DeMint and I sort of took a look at where conservatives currently stand in this moment and realized that no one really knew what conservatism stood for. The left is trying to redefine us as racists and bigots. And, you know, even people on the right aren't really sure. And so this book is our attempt to rearticulate the principles and values of the conservative tradition for this modern moment. And we went back and we sort of update and distill a lot of the old conservative thinkers, Russell Kirk and Edmund Burke. But we try to do it in an approachable way, really tailored to our current politics and our current policy fights. Because at the end of the day, conservatism isn't just a reflexive policy agenda or a bunch of, you know, slogans. It's really a philosophy, a way of living, and it's a philosophy of gratefulness. It's being grateful for everything we have and what has come before us and knowing what to keep out of that. You know, we don't keep everything, but there are certain traditions and timeless values that we know make this country great, and that's what we want to keep.
I'll also one just play on words, because I think, you know, words become so familiar that we lose their meaning. We are, those of us that are conservative, we want to conserve what's good. We want to save. We want to set apart. We want to hang on to the good stuff, the stuff that has been tried and through the ages, like the Constitution and other things like that, and values, the family, the cohesiveness of that as the foundation of society. We want to conserve those things. And I think we've lost, you know, it's become a word without meaning. And that really is what it means. But let me just say that the book is called Conservative, Knowing What to Keep, again, with Jim DeMint and Rachel Bovard, with a foreword by Congressman Jim Jordan, who you all know is one of my favorites. Rachel, before we say goodbye today, there's a specific issue that grabs me and grabs you, too, because you wrote about it. You say Senate Republicans are betraying pro-lifers. Once again, shall I add, you didn't put that in your headline, but tell us what's happening with that.
Yeah, this is a really important issue, and it goes back to the budget deal that was struck over the summer. Republican leadership said to the pro-life community, you have to line up and support this $1 trillion deal to make sure, you know, and in exchange, we will make sure that Democrats don't touch any of the abortion riders in the spending bills at the end of the year. That was the deal that was made, but yet we are now at the end of the year. We're starting to see these spending bills come up, and Senate Republicans are doing nothing to stop Jean Shaheen from New Hampshire of putting millions of dollars into this bill specifically for abortion, specifically to undermine the efforts of President Trump to reinstate the Mexico City policy, which limits taxpayer money going to foreign abortion providers overseas. She directly undoes that. She got no pushback from Senate Republicans, who swore up and down to pro-lifers that they would be there on this issue for them. And, you know, so yet again, you're seeing a lot of promises made and not being kept by Senate Republicans when it comes to pro-life priorities.
It's disgusting. And the House does the same thing. And the pro-life groups salute and bow, and with very few exceptions. I've been in that battle before, Rachel. It's disgusting to me, I have to tell you. The last time I remember really being on the front lines of this was when the Planned Parenthood selling baby body parts videos came out, and we tried to get them to defund Planned Parenthood, and they promised, they kept patting pro-lifers on the head and saying, oh, no, we can't shut down the government, but we'll take care of it later. But, of course, they didn't. That's the short version, because they never do. Rachel, I really appreciate your time today. Thank you so much. And again, let me tell you that her new book with Senator Jim DeMint is Conservative, Knowing What to Keep. And we'll put this other article of hers, Senate Republicans Are Betraying Pro-Lifers. There's more detail in it, and you need to read and share it, as I know that you will. Rachel, thank you so much. And thanks to all of you for listening this week. And thank you for your generous giving with Share-a-thon. Thank you so much. Sandy Rios, in the morning on AFR Talk.